I'm David Scobie, and I'm the director of the Harward Center for Community Partnerships here at Bates. The Harward Center is an academic center within Bates College. Our mission is to foster collaboration and civic engagement between the college and our larger communities. We aim to bring the college's educational gifts to the enriching of community and civic life, and in the process to integrate civic and community concerns into the Bates education, interweaving active learning and active citizenship. Much of our programming concerns immediate community needs and problems, and we support that with academic service learning and community-based research and volunteer programs and other activities. But we also aim to connect community-based educational work to larger issues of citizenship, politics, and policy, and that's our purpose with this new Civic Forum series, inaugurated this year. The Civic Forum aims to bring together diverse voices to discuss and to deliberate important civic and policy issues affecting the Bates community, the Maine community, and the larger world. This year's forums have been focused on the theme of reimagining Maine in the 21st century. Tonight's panel is the third and the final forum, following discussions on poverty in the two Maines and reimagining globalism, Maine, and the world economy. At a time of dramatic, even fateful change in Maine's economy, environment, and community life, we hope that these forums will spark engaged discussion on complex issues that lead to informed action. Before I introduce tonight's theme and speakers, let me take a minute to thank folks who were indispensable in organizing the whole Civic Forum series and tonight's panel. First of all, Peggy Rotundo, our fellow staffer at the Harward Center and our state senator, for conceptualizing the series and drawing on her own extraordinary knowledge and connections across the state to bring together such diverse and dynamic panels. Kristen Cloutier and Brenda Pelletier of the Harward Center, who helped organize and oversee these forums. The Bates Office for Communications and Media Relations and Bates Media Services for giving us indispensable help with publicity and recording. And finally, Maine Public Broadcasting Network, which has agreed to broadcast all of these civic forums on its public affairs radio show, Speaking in Maine. And finally, we want to thank all of you for coming out and being with us. When Peggy Rotundo and I first brainstormed the idea for a series of forums on complex, important, knotty public issues that seemed essential for Mainers to think and talk about together, the words North Woods and Plum Creek were the first ones that came into my mind. I was fascinated as a newcomer to Maine by an issue that seemed to lie at the intersection of so many consequential choices and changes. The future of the North Woods, it seems to me, involves large, even catastrophic change in resource economics, environment, law and land use arrangements, and regional community life. The collapse of the timber industry, the expansion of eco and recreational tourism, large shifts in land ownership, depopulation and economic decline in many Northwoods communities, and now ambitious proposals for both environmental preservation and recreational and vacation home development. Most notoriously, the Plum Creek Corporation's proposal to develop the Moosehead Lake region. All of these changes and plans and battles seem to put northern Maine at a fateful crossroads. The stakeholders in those debates bring understandable passion, both fear and hope, to that crossroads. And often it seems to me they have trouble hearing each other in the cross volley of environmental and economic and community concerns. If there were ever a need for a civic conversation that is at once critical and empathetic, that engages people with divergent values and interests in a spirit of democratic creativity, this is the issue. I think we have brought together a panel that can advance such a conversation tonight. We have three important voices in current discussions over the North Woods and its environmental, economic, and community implications. Let me introduce each of them in the order that I've asked them to speak. First, David Vail. David is the Adams Catlin Professor of Economics at Bowdoin College. Earlier in his career, he split his time largely between Bowdoin and East African countries, where he was a rural development advisor, specializing in agricultural and agricultural development and appropriate technology. Here in Maine, David is co-director of the Maine Center for Economic, is director of a project of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, Spreading Prosperity to All of Maine. He's served on the Maine Governor's Steering Committee on Natural Resource-Based Industries, the Maine House Speaker's Tax Reform Advisory Committee, and many other statewide and local pro bono initiatives. Next, Matt Polsting. Matt is a Millinocket entrepreneur, owner of New England Outfitters Center, and a member of the Millinocket Town Council. He's an important voice in the region for ecotourism development and currently engaged in developing a sustainable broad-based tourism initiative called Katahdin Resorts. And finally, Ted Kaufman. Ted is the Director of Government and Community Relations at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. For the past 8 years, he has served 4 terms in the State House representing his home community on Mount Desert Island. He's chair of the Natural Resources Committee and also of one of its subcommittees, the Community Preservation Advisory Committee, which oversees issues of growth management and the implications of growth for communities. When I asked him what else he wanted me to mention in his introduction, he said that he had been involved in a lot of mischief involving issues of smart growth, growth management, quality of life issues, ecosystem, and public life. He helped to found the State of Environment Report and the Smart Growth Forum in the 1990s, all part of an initiative called Eco-Eco, which tried to think together issues of economy and ecology for Maine. So we have a wonderful and diverse panel. I've asked each of them to speak for about 15 minutes or so and to leave lots of time for our conversation and your questions. David Vail, start us off.
Thanks, David. I want to congratulate Bates and David first on this set of forums. I've had a chance to hear other ones, previous ones, on the radio, and it was a pretty scintillating discussion. I hope we can replicate that tonight. The theme, reimagining the Northern Forest, I think is really thought-provoking, and it's absolutely urgent. And one of the things I want to do is give you some of the reasons why I think we have to reimagine the Northern Forest in the 21st century. There are a lot of social and economic and ecological indicators that suggest we're not on a sustainable path. But at the same time, I don't want people to leave the room thinking that all is dire. There actually is some pretty exciting reimagining going on in the Northern Forest and for the Northern Forest region. In fact, when you hear Matt Polstein talk about some of his endeavors, I think you'll see we have a kind of living, breathing example of reimagining in our presence today. So we've established a kind of division of labor among the three of us, and my task as the social scientist is to do a kind of pragmatic, not very ideological overview of what's happening in the Northern Forest, both the urgency of reimagining and some of those indicators that reimagining is going on. I would say that for me, David mentioned that I co-direct a project at the Maine Center for Economic Policy that's called Spreading Prosperity to All of Maine, and the focus is the 6 RIM counties from Oxford around to the north to Aroostook County and then down east to Washington County. And I would like to sort of accentuate some of the work that I do in that project, which focuses primarily on tourism and on the question of how, whether and how we can create a world-class destination for tourists in the Northern Forest region. That implies I don't think we're there yet. So, warning before I get started, this overview is going to be very sketchy. 15 minutes for an academic is like an instant. If you sit through classes at Bates, you know most of us don't get going until about 30 or 40 minutes into a class. So I'll try to keep it brief and succinct. But what it means is that a lot of detail is going to be left out, and I hope we can come back and have a little bit deeper conversation about some of these points during the Q&A. So what I'd like to start with is what I think are 7 indicators that suggest that reimagining in the Northern Forest region is crucial. The first of those David already hinted at. It's the stagnation and or decline in the traditional resource-based industries of the region. I think David used the word the collapse of the lumber industry. It's far from collapse, I would say, but it's certainly not in very good shape. Employment has been dropping quite dramatically. The capacity to sustain the revenue base of rural communities, company towns, has deteriorated as well. That's a story virtually everybody here, I think, is familiar with. People may be less familiar with the fact that many of the key traditional forms of outdoor recreation in a second part of the northern forest economy, that is the tourism economy, are also either stagnant or declining. So if we looked at hunting and fishing licenses, camping, whitewater rafting, something that Matt's deeply involved in, even alpine skiing, we see that the numbers are down over the last decade or more in all of those kinds of activity. Numbers of people going to Baxter State Park is down 30% over the last 5 or 6 years. The numbers in the Allagash are down 70%, a pretty dramatic decline. In other words, if we think of forest products, industries, and tourism as historical mainstays of this region, they're not in very good shape at the present time. That was indicator number one. Indicator number two is that as a result of these trends, at least in part as a result, we see chronic economic and community distress, something that David also hinted at. And since I live on the coast, I would note a widening gap between the prosperity of coastal and southern Maine with the northern forest region. We can find that in indicators like much lower average income levels, much higher poverty levels. In Piscataquis and Somerset County, where I've been doing some research, about one in seven people falls below the federal poverty line, and that's really poor. That's far below a livable wage standard. It's not that great in Cumberland County where I live, but it's at least one out of 12 people living in poverty, so you get a sense of the difference. Unemployment rate is twice as high in that area as it is in the Portland area, and one of the most conspicuous signs is that people are leaving, especially the younger generation. And in fact, in an earlier project I did on farming communities and their dynamics in Maine, I was talking to the principal of the Holton High School, and he said, you know, people think of us as growing a lot of potatoes and a lot of trees, but the biggest export from Aroostook County is the top third of the high school graduating class. That's what's happening in rural Maine. Along with these indicators, we get a more long-term kind of demographics, and that's the demographics of an aging population. Maine, by some indicators, is the oldest state in the United States. The Rim counties are the oldest part of the oldest state in the United States. It's, of course, in part because of the exodus of younger people. We have an aging population, a growing dependent population in that part of the state. Indicator number four, if we think about government's capacity to respond to these kinds of challenges, the first observation I'd make is that Maine has never had a coherent or persistent rural development policy, and we certainly don't have one now. Ted, we may want to talk a little bit more about whether the legislature can do something about that, but I think probably not. On top of that, in terms of states' capabilities, everybody here knows that the state's resources are very tight at the moment. In fact, they're always tight in Maine. There are never flush times for the Maine state budget. And what's going on in the Rim counties de facto is a kind of triage. We see it with school consolidation, not something I speak in opposition to. It's an inevitability, I think. But the reality is that small communities losing population are facing the necessity to consolidate schools, emergency services, medical care, and other kinds of services that really change the quality of life at the community level. So our government at the state level doesn't have the capacity to help rural communities that are in distress as it should. Indicator number five, something that I think may have brought a number of the students in the audience to this discussion, is the transformation of land ownership and the cumulative change in land use patterns that we see in the northern forest region. If we had had this conference 15 years ago, I would have made some kind of glib statement that, well, 60% of all of the land area in the unorganized territories is owned by about half a dozen large paper companies that are supplying their own mills. That figures down to 15% now, and it's mostly Irving Paper, a Canadian company that owns that land. The proportion is sharply rising for a set of investor categories that I had never heard of 10 years ago. TIMOs, Timber Investment Management Organizations, REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts. And, of course, Plum Creek is one of the latter and has become notorious, is the word that David used. Some of us would use a different adjective. But Plum Creek is certainly the real estate investment trust that's captured the headlines recently. By the way, just getting ahead of my story a little bit, I'm sort of summarizing some bad news now. I would say there's good news as well on the front of dramatic changes in land ownership and land use. One of those is that a couple million acres in the northern forest region are now under protection, either through public acquisition, trust, land trust, or conservation group acquisition, or under conservation easement. And we may want to talk a little bit later. I think, Jeff, you've written about the dubious quality of some conservation easements, so it's not that I'm trying to say this has solved a problem, but there's good news, I think, in the transformation of land ownership as well. And maybe along with that, I could mention that something like 7 million, approaching 7 million acres in the unorganized territories are now certified as sustainably managed by either the, primarily by the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, a kind of industry-run certification scheme. So, indicator number six, getting back to the bad news. Anybody who lives in Maine at all knows that the cost of fuel oil is rising and that the cost of transportation fuel is rising. This sharp rise in the cost of liquid fossil fuels puts any chilly, remote, sparsely populated part of the United States in a particular kind of vulnerability. There's no indication that that's going to turn around anytime soon. And in many different ways, I think we could say the northern forest region is vulnerable, and you might say that there's likely to be a kind of slowly gathering crisis for Maine's export economy and for the way of life of people in the northern forest. Indicator number seven, I'll just say in two words, and maybe we'll come back to it later, climate change. I'll add a couple more words. I'm a faculty member, after all. We don't know yet what the near-term, middle-term, or long-term impacts of climate change will be in the northern forest region. There's some scientific modeling and speculation on that, but what we know is that it's unavoidable. Those impacts are in the pipeline, whether they are beneficial or adverse or whatever the mix of those might be. So this all does sound a little bit dire, but I wanted to stress that there are lots of encouraging signs, too, that reimagining is actually going on in the northern forest, activities, initiatives, innovations that I think will contribute to sustainable rural prosperity. So here are a few that just struck me this morning when I was putting together some notes for this talk. They're a little bit random, and many more could be added. First, we have a strong commitment, state commitment, to spreading high-speed internet access to northern and down east Maine. We're not completely there yet, but this is crucial for things like modernizing healthcare services, like long-distance diagnostics in the more remote parts of the state. It's going to be crucial if we're ever going to attract mobile entrepreneurs who could choose to come here, or they could choose to go to Tallahassee or Stanford, California. We'd like to get some of them to come to northern Maine. That's going to be a necessary condition, far from a sufficient condition, to get people to relocate businesses in Maine. Second, we see downtown revitalization initiatives going on in places like Norway, Maine, close to here, Skowhegan, Calais, Maine, down east. This enhances the quality of life of rural residents directly. We tend to think it also is one of the things that can attract more tourists to gateway communities to have attractive places to visit. Sorry, Matt, I didn't include Millinocket in that list. I'm not sure it's the beauty spot of northern Maine. But I think that's a very encouraging process because even though there's some state support through, say, the Main Street Maine Initiative in Skowhegan, it's largely local people who are getting their act together and saying we want a better quality of life. If we're going to attract what I call mobile entrepreneurs, if we're going to attract affluent retirees to the more remote parts of the state, I think that you know, attractive downtowns are also part of that. A third thing I'd mention is that we're moving toward some exciting new generations of forest products. I don't know that we can say we'll ever replace the paper industry in its heyday in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, but in 10 years, it seems to me very likely that we'll see bioplastics from timber. We might very well see cellulosic ethanol. I think many of you have probably read in the last couple of weeks the huge economic and environmental problems associated with ethanol from crops like corn and, well, and soybeans as a biodiesel fuel rather than ethanol. On an environmental grounds, it looks more promising from trees, although economically we're not there yet. But the point is we're moving in that direction. In fact, talking about bioethanol or cellulosic ethanol, I would branch out and say one of the other exciting kinds of reimagining is that we're thinking about wind power seriously, renewable energy in general from the northern forest region, if not from the trees. And some of you are aware, I'm sure, that the governor's wind power task force has recently presented its report calling for 3,000 megawatts by 2020. That's pretty ambitious, but it's doable, I think. And most of the locations, most of the sites for that will, in the near term at least, will be in the northern forest region. Finally, I think there's a lot of good news on the tourism front. I talked about some of the declines in traditional forms of tourism a couple minutes ago, but there are innovations going on left and right, and if I had an hour, I could do justice to this, but in a couple of minutes, I'll just say a word or two under three headings: trails, resorts, and cultural and heritage attractions. We live in the era of tourist trails, and I think one of the exciting events of the last couple of weeks was when Maine Hudson Trails, which is building 180-mile ski and cross-country skiing and mountain biking trail from the Mahoosuc Range up to Moosehead, had the grand opening of their first lodge up south of Bigelow in the Carabasset Valley. Lots of other trails, the Fiber Arts Trail. How many of you had heard of the Fiber Arts Trail in Maine? Or the Kennebec-Chaudière Trail, celebrating Revolutionary War, Franco-American forest industry history, and the two rivers that go all the way from Quebec City down to Fort Popham. I could go on and on about trails. But let me say a word or two about resorts, because it's part of the lead into what Matt will have to say. Do I have a couple more minutes? Can I take a couple more? Okay. Resorts applying eco-design, like LEED, leadership and environmental and energy design principles, and also committed to providing the highest quality possible service. If we're ever going to get to world-class in Maine tourism, I think it's going to take resorts as anchors for that process, and it's going to take ones that have a reputation for being environmentally top-notch and top-notch in terms of the variety and quality of their services. Matt is developing exactly one of those resorts in the Millinocket-Katahdin region, so he'll tell us a little bit more about that. Finally, cultural and heritage. It's been out there all along, right? Our Franco-American heritage, the Native American heritage, Paul Bunyan and the logging heritage. But we haven't done much with it in the past. And so there are exciting new ventures like the Maine Mountain Heritage Network, soon to spread its wings geographically and become the Great Maine Woods Consortium of groups trying to upgrade the quality of our culture and heritage offerings, network them more effectively, in effect help to develop a brand for Maine tourism around our culture and heritage. I think realists would say people are not likely to come to northern Maine the way they might go to the Champlain Valley or the Hudson River Valley because of history. But if we can find a way to marry nature and culture effectively, in fact, I'll mention the Thoreau Wabanaki Trail is another starting at Greenville that is all about that. It's bringing those two things together. I think that has some really exciting potential. So if David will tell me how many more minutes I have, I'll tell you if I have a couple more, I'll tell you about my work.
You do have a couple more
minutes. Okay, a couple more minutes. Thank you. I just want to give you a thumbnail sketch. of what I've been working on more or less since a Blaine House conference in 2003 on Maine's natural resource-based industries. And that is trying to answer the question, what would it take for the northern forest region of Maine to attain some ineffable world-class status? If you read some of the documents that come out of the State Planning Office or the Office of Tourism, you see that term being used. I'm still a little mystified about what it means, and we can go into definitions if you want to later. But it seems to me we aren't there yet, and based on what I said before, some parts of tourism in rural Maine are kind of going in the wrong direction and may need to be revitalized. The problems I see with the trails, the resorts, the cultural and heritage attractions, and many other things that are going on is that they tend to be piecemeal. They're going on in a fragmented way. There is no coherent strategy that brings them together. And that we face some pretty damn sophisticated competitors, whether we're talking about the Adirondacks or New Brunswick close by, or whether we're talking about the Rocky Mountains and the Norwegian fjords. We live in a world of internet communication and international travel, and we've got to realize that's our competition too. It's not just can we outdo the White Mountains, you know, to attract tourists. So the thumbnail sketch of what I've been advocating and occasionally getting shot down, but at least having some pretty interesting discussions, is a three-part strategy. Part one is to take those 2 million acres that I described before as being under some form of protection and reconceptualizing that and investing in it as a Great Maine Woods recreation area. With apologies to Jim St. Pierre from Restore the North Woods, it's a little like getting the economic bang of a national park without the national park. And Jim may want to talk about that a little more during the Q&A. To move a little bit toward what Ted Kaufman may talk about in a minute, I see this as potentially part of a twin parks situation where we have Acadia National Park on the coast, where we have the Great Maine Woods Recreation Area in the interior, where we invest a whole lot more in the so-called green infrastructure of trails and signage and lodging and dining, all the things that make a destination, and then having Bangor as the hub of those two places. There's still rail lines from Bangor up to Moosehead Lake, for example. There's the possibility of reviving that. And given what I said about transportation vulnerabilities, any tourism strategy for the next 10, 20, or 30 years is going to have to take transportation much more seriously than we ever had before. It's partly about repairing potholes and all those crummy roads up in the Northwoods, but it's a whole lot more than that. So that's one little piece. I'd be happy to talk about it more later. The second piece is to take the efforts in the area of contemporary culture and heritage a step farther, and that is to move toward getting congressional designation of Great Maine Woods National Heritage Area. That's what exists in the northern Hudson River Valley, for example, or in the Appalachians or Essex County, Massachusetts, which means that the federal government, this is a little tricky to say accurately, the National Park Service becomes a support entity for this. A National Heritage Area can use the National Park Service logo and gets a lot of free promo from that. In other words, it really ups the profile, but it doesn't entail any federal ownership and management the way a national park or a national forest would. So if you don't believe me, we can talk about that in more detail a little bit later as well. The third piece, I would call it a campaign for service excellence and quality jobs. We have best practice tourism service operators in everything from outfitters to restaurants. In fact, I think Matt provides world-class outfitting and restaurants in his current operations up in the Katahdin region. But the sad story is that tourism in Maine is, by and large, an industry. It's not an industry, really. It's a conglomeration of small businesses. And average practice, if I could use that term, falls far below best practice. And so I see the need for a kind of two-pronged strategy. One is to develop much more effective outreach programs to small business operators so they understand what world-class means. I think a lot of them wouldn't recognize it if it hit them in the face, but to help them figure out how to get from here to there. And the second prong has to do with this crucial fact. In many kinds of tourism services, it's the frontline workers, it's the wage earners who are the face-to-face people in face-to-face contact with tourists. They're the ones whose quality of service, whose personalities and attitudes are going to affect the quality of the experience, and therefore, if we're ever going to get to world class, my view is we've got to have a much more skilled, more highly motivated workforce, and that means moving. We'll never get to all great tourism jobs paying a livable wage with health benefits and good pension plans, but I think we could get a lot better than the 40% of tourism jobs that now meet that sort of standard. So frontline worker training is another crucial part of this. And again, as I said before, if you would like to talk about one or more of these components of what I call the big push to world-class tourism destination, I'd be happy to do that during Q&A. So I think I probably overspent my time. Thanks for your patience.
Thanks, Steve. So much, David, for that really great mapping of the issues.
Matt Polstein.
Thank you, David. If I can get away with it with a sound system, I think I'd like to stand up so the people in the back of the room don't feel completely left out. I also like to stand when I talk. First, I'd like to say it's a real honor for me to be here from Northern Maine, taking part in your forum and talking about the future of a part of the state that's my home and my family's home and that I feel very passionately about. And I'd like to take a few minutes at the beginning of my time to sort of continue to frame for you how important the debate about the future of Northern Maine and the forested fringe of Maine is from the context of the people that live there and work there or work there. I live in the town of Millinocket, which if you're from Maine, you're probably familiar with as the old home of Great Northern Paper Company. The town of East Millinocket's brand or slogan is the town that paper made. And it's a really, the history of the area is incredible. In 1899, there was virtually nothing there, a few farmers or homesteaders that were in the area. And 3 years later, there was one of the largest paper mills in America there, and soon to be developed the largest hydroelectric system privately owned in the world. And it was built virtually out of the wilderness. People called it the Magic City, Millinocket, because one day it wasn't there, and the next day it was. It was built by immigrants that were brought here for their specific skills, tradespeople that knew how to build the mill, how to run the mill, how to make paper in the mill. And for many, many, many years, it was an economic engine not only for Northern Maine, but for the entire state. It had tremendous political clout. And it had great stature in the state of Maine. In the mid-80s, the president of the mill gave a speech which most people didn't pay a lot of attention to, but he talked about the changing dynamic in globalization and competition and changing dynamics in papermaking in Maine and in the United States. And he talked about the need for investment in his mill there and basically said, if we don't invest in this mill, our trajectory will only go one way from here, and that's down. To put a perspective on how fast and how far it went down, in the mid-80s, there were 2,000 students in the school system and about 8,000 people living in the community of Millinocket. Today, there are about 650 students in the school system. This is 20-plus years later. And there are about 4,500 to 5,000 people, according to the 2000 census, living in the town of Millinocket. In 2003, the unthinkable happened. Great Northern went bankrupt and closed its doors. At the time that it went bankrupt, it had about 1,200 employees. It's now completely back open, with the exception of one paper machine that was running just prior to the bankruptcy in Millinocket, but it only has about 600 employees. And as Dave quickly jumped on the comment about the timber industry being, timber industry being in a state of crisis or collapse, I think it's important to view it more as in a state of transformation. Even though there are only 600 people working at those mills now, they make slightly more paper than they made when the mill closed down in 2003. And they have been forced to basically optimize the production of those mills to stay competitive in an intensely competitive global market. There's good news in the bad news, and that is that our mills in Millinocket appear to have stabilized, and they have the potential to run and be an economic engine, I'll bet, without the employment that they once had. And I would offer that when people talk about the paper industry being dead, it's because, or dying, it's because of the employment being so much less than it used to be. But the reality is that they are an incredible economic engine still for all of Maine, and particularly for Northern Maine. And they buy the same raw materials, they produce the same tonnage or more than they produced in their heyday, they just require less employment to do it. They are still a vulnerable industry, and Maine is, by the perspective of most people in business in Maine, a tough climate to do business in. So we need to be careful to reasonably nurture our paper industry and our timber industry, and it can function sustainably for a long, long time in partnership with the new opportunities that we're here to talk about to build a stronger economy for Northern Maine. Northern Maine has always, if you want to look at what its economic future is, if you want to look to the 21st century, I think it's really simple. Natural assets and their use have always defined our economic strength. They define the past, consumptive and non-consumptive use of our wilderness resources and our natural assets that are in the area, and they will define the future. They will define it in a different way. The consumptive uses traditionally have been timber in a significant fashion, hunting and fishing, where people engaged in those activities from an extractive standpoint, and many others. The non-consumptive uses that are growing are nature, eco, adventure, agri, cultural, historical, geotourism, or a host of other names that people use to talk about tourism that can take place without being extractive in its use of the resources. The consumptive uses and the non-consumptive uses that I just mentioned, while the balance historically was weighted towards confidence, may shift towards an era where it's a more healthy balance between the two. And I think the defining thought that we all need to consider as we weigh what the opportunities are for bringing these together is that good stewardship of the assets has been and remains critical to the economic, social, and environmental health of the area. And the opportunity for the Northern Forest community to grow remains in the hands of good stewards of the area. Two hallmarks of good stewardship, as I define them, are sustainability and compatibility. We can have uses in the Northern Forest that sustain the resources that allow that use to take place and other uses to take place. They have to be compatible. The tone has to be compatible. The tenor has to be compatible. And it doesn't mean that everywhere in the North Woods, everything has to happen. There are benefits from specialization, having some areas of the North Woods whose focus is more intensive forestry, some areas whose focus might be biodiversity, very non-consumptive or no-consumptive uses, motorized recreation in some areas, non-motorized recreation in others, and the balance or the bulk of the area supporting commonly all of those different values that are important to the people of the state of Maine. Development, when it's talked about in terms of tourism in the Northern Forest, is also viewed with a high level of scrutiny, which is a good thing, but it's also often viewed negatively. And the comment that quickly comes to people's mind when they think about development is, well, you're going to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And that's a paradigm that I think needs some rethinking. The first thing that I would argue is someone who lives and works in Northern Maine, as opposed to someone who views it as a place of sanctuary or a place to travel to recreate to, is that the goose isn't laying the golden egg for the people that live there. It has the potential to. And the new paradigm is that we need to nurture the goose so that it does. Part of that nurturing is coming to some agreement politically and as a broader population on what the right balance of these uses and locations for these competing potential uses are. And also an understanding that timber, a hallmark of the state's historic, social, economic, and environmental status, will play a role and needs to play a role in the future. So when we try to define that balance of sustainability, we need to remember that the economic engine of the area that's there today needs to be a part of it in the future. We need to diversify, and again, the towns of Millinocket and East Millinocket are great examples of why. Not only has the population declined, the schools declined, the community sense of well-being certainly declined, but those mills pay 85% of the taxes in the town of East Millinocket and about 50% of the taxes in Millinocket. The mills, by the nature of their existence and the voracious appetite they had for employees, created an environment where no other businesses, no other types of businesses sought to locate or develop. And so we ended up with an economic monoculture, the results of which were evident when the mill shut its doors and then opened with substantially fewer employees than it once had. I want to come back to the idea of development and the goose that lays the golden egg. The state of Maine, from a policy standpoint right now, encourages in the forest or on the forested fringe the development of low-intensity development or activities. For instance, it's very easy to build a small sporting camp both within the forest, not along the forest fringe, but deeper in the forest in a zone called the management zone. And it's quite easy to develop campsites and campgrounds. A good example of this would be in Millinocket in both the unorganized territory, which is a regulatory term. If you're not familiar with it, it's a designation of unorganized political bodies, if you will, or land masses without a political body organizing them that have their, most relevant to us, have their development oversight come from the Land Use Regulation Commission. And then you have the organized communities of the towns, Millinocket, East Millinocket, Medway, where they have their own zoning body. In all of those areas, there's a bias that makes it easy to build campgrounds or campsites. And in the Katahdin region, as an example, the bed base is about 3,000 campsites or camping spaces for people, not 3,000 campsites. And there's a bed base in real beds that people can sleep in that's not much more than 400. So we've set up an environment in that area, duplicated in many cases around the state, where lots and lots of people can stay but generate very little economic activity when they're staying. David mentioned earlier that the use trends for that type of activity, remote recreation, camping, have been declining in our area. I represent the younger age of the demographic, the baby boomers, who as they've grown older seem to seek and require a higher level of amenity and service. We all used to be happy camping. We now are looking for a little bit softer bed, a better meal, and maybe even a massage or a mud bath while we're there getting it. That's great news for Northern Maine as far as I'm concerned, because if we develop these assets, we can create much more economic bang for the visitor's buck than we can if someone's just sleeping in a campground and recreating on their own. In no way should those comments be construed to mean that I don't support people that engage in those activities. There's tremendous opportunity for primitive recreation, backcountry recreation, hiking, camping, and roughing it, if you will. What Maine lacks, as was pointed out earlier, are facilities that can provide a higher level of service, better paying jobs, and a greater level of stimulation for the economy of the area. We have proposed a project in the Katahdin region that seeks to do that, and we've proposed it for a variety of reasons. Much again, like David, I've been engaged for many years on panels, attended the Governor's Conference on Natural Resource-Based Industries, I think back in 2003 with David, and have talked about ways to build the tourism trade so that it plays a greater role, a better role in shaping the social quality, the environmental quality, and the economic quality of life in the fringe of the Northern Forest. And none of the initiatives that people talk about, all of which need to happen together in order for them to be really successful, critical mass is a missing phenomenon. In Northern Maine. It's a missing phenomenon in many parts of Maine. We don't have enough activity to make people excited about coming to a region and staying there for a long period of time. That I decided that I was in an area that had spectacular natural beauty, a collection of these natural assets that was unmatched from my perspective around the state, and that someone needed to bring together the many aspects of tourism, cultural, historical, agricultural, adventure, nature-based tourism in the middle of a facility that provided the level of comfort and service, that mud bath if you want it, the spa service, thank you for the reminder, all in one location and could hopefully become a model for appropriate development along the forested fringe. My development, there's a little irony in my development. In the spirit of full disclosure, I'll tell you that I testified as an expert witness in Plum Creek's plan, and I generally support, with the conservation components intact, the idea of Plum Creek developing as they've proposed in the Moosehead Lake area. But to put my project in context, when I first talked to the Land Use Regulation Commission about it, they said, wow, this is, you know, by far the biggest thing we've ever looked at. It was, at the time, the vision was for an 80-room lodge, seven clustered family lodges, we called them around it, which would sleep roughly 20 people each, a residential subdivision of about 40 lots with a little village center and an agriculturally themed village, and then another piece of development, 40 acres in an area that had resort homes in it. And they said, this is by far the biggest thing we've ever looked for. Looked like it was a daunting issue for them to consider. Well, 3 months later, Plum Creek announced its plan, the scale of which was so much greater than ours that I think our project became de facto reasonable in some sense because of the scale of what Plum Creek had to offer. That's funny, and I laugh about it, but it's not funny because our project, were it scaled any smaller than it is, would not be economically feasible. And it's truly questionable whether or not in the environment we're in right now with the subprime crisis and the real estate collapse, our project's feasible today as we've proposed it. The cost of doing business in northern Maine, where you need to bring in power infrastructure, build a mile or two of road to get to your site, train a workforce that doesn't exist now, bring in and import, or in our case, we're fortunate in that there's a large available workforce in our area, though they will need to be trained to meet the standards of a more demanding guest. All of those things cost a lot of money, and you can't do it at a small scale. And we can't create the sense of critical excitement that we need to with our project without building all of these many components into it. I will sit down and be happy to answer questions about that or any of the issues I see facing Northern Maine at the end. But
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Matt. Ted Kaufman.
Thank you. Well, David talked about how hard it is for an academic to limit himself to 15 minutes. It's much worse for politicians, as Senator Rotundo knows. One of the most frequently used words in the opening sentence of a floor speech is, "I'll be brief," and we rarely are very brief. So, but I'll try and be as concise as I can. How many of you have ever been to Bar Harbor, Maine, where I live? That's good. We're doing very well in Bar Harbor. And how many of you have been to Baxter State Park? That's terrific, too. Excellent. All right. Okay, we've got an audience who know the territory. Well, I want to speak a little bit about Maine's brand, and I don't know how many of you are familiar, so I'll look for another show of hands, with the Brookings Report, the so-called Brookings Report that was produced by, several, so I'm not going to dwell on it. But it has been, if you happen to get a chance to visit the school library, I'm sure that there are copies of Brookings there. The Grow Smart Maine outfit, who have been doing a lot for us in Maine in the discussion about how we grow and develop and the issue of sprawl, helped and ushered in this Brookings report 2 years ago, which looked at development patterns in the state, the state's assets, its strengths, its weaknesses. But for me, especially interesting was their look at the quality of place that Maine represents and what are the characteristics that define the quality of place that influence the quality of our lives, our day-to-day lives. And as they describe that, they get into discussing Maine's brand. And it's kind of interesting. It feels like we're talking about a cold cereal or something. But they talked about Maine's brand and that brand needs to be protected and well-defined. But it will influence and shape our economic future. It will shape our destiny. We will build that economic future around those qualities that define the brand. And I kind of accept that, and I think we've thought about that for quite a long time before Brookings, but the value of Brookings was bringing us together to in kind of defining and framing the discussion around the future prosperity in Maine and the importance of that brand and protecting it and enhancing it and in many cases restoring it, because I want to speak a little bit about ways in which that brand, I think, is being tarnished, and a reputation once tarnished is hard to restore. Acadia National Park is a kind of case in point about the goose and the golden eggs and the influence of quality of place on an economy. As you may or may not know, Acadia National Park was created in 1904, roughly. George Dorr began to put together a whole set of gifted parcels and spent funds donated to the park to create Acadia National Park. Almost every park that had no inhabitants didn't face uphill battles, but all the parks that we've created, the Boundary Waters, the Adirondacks, the Allegash, Baxter, and Acadia National Park ran into resistance, very strong resistance, particularly from local interests and local economic interests. And it was true certainly at Acadia. At one point, when this park was getting created and they needed to be authorized by the Maine state legislature to move forward before it went on to Congress and the president, there was an effort in our local community to put a stop to it in the Maine legislature. So we came fairly close to not having Acadia National Park. But fortunately, the Speaker of the House at the time was from Ellsworth, and he supported the park and stopped this attempt to kill it. The park obviously didn't come first. We had fishing villages. We had an economy. We had charming towns. We had a small population. But it was the summer population that developed around the absolutely unmatchable, unparalleled beauty of Acadia National Park and the accessibility of the park, even back in the 19th century, by steamboat and by train, that brought summer people from Philadelphia and Washington and New York to enjoy their summers in the area of Acadia National Park, Northeast Harbor, Seal Harbor, et cetera, Bar Harbor. That money helped support the development of institutions like the Jackson Laboratory for Genetic Research, which is a world-class research institution with over 1,200 employees, and coincidentally is the largest employer in Hancock County now, whereas it wasn't very long ago that the Bucksport Paper Mill, once the IP, now the Verso Mill, was the largest employer. They have half the employees now that they did 20 years ago. The Jackson Lab has three times more employees and is still growing as a world-class research institution. And scale is important to them as it is to you, Matt. And so they need to keep growing to compete and to have the diversity of scientists and equipment that their research requires. But we have the Jackson Lab. We have the Mount Desert Island Biological Lab. We have my employer, College of the Atlantic. And we have some exquisite boats being built by Hinckley's and Morris Yachts. All of that really happened not simply because we had Acadia National Park, but because we had a summer community who wanted those wonderful boats and who were serving on the boards of those institutions like the lab and the college and helped fund their development and existence. All that said, the population has grown on the island, and we face some of the issues that all national parks seem to face. And this gets back to the goose and the golden egg, which include things like sprawl. Here we have a park with, if you've visited, and many of you have, half the island of Mount Desert is roughly is Acadia National Park. The other half is privately owned property. And we've calculated at the college that we have something like 1,400 more development lots that could be built on surrounding the park, and we've developed hundreds and hundreds of lots in the last 20 years. So imagine an aerial view of New York City. When New York City developed Central Park, that beautiful green rectangle in the middle of Manhattan, when they proposed building that around the time of the Civil War, people said, that's nonsense. Look at all the open space we have in Manhattan. We don't need a park. We have farms and plenty of open space. But they moved it forward, another park that had resistance, but they moved forward with that park. And I'm concerned that here we have this gem of a park, Acadia National Park, and it's still a gem. But with the development pressure, we one day, maybe 20, 30, 50 years from now, will see all that privately owned land and all the habitat that's privately owned now that's actually a part of the larger habitat of Acadia National Park, we don't want to forget that, that will be lost to development of 3 and 5 acre lots of very expensive second homes and year-round residences. So we'll have a park being hugged, wrapped, just like Central Park is with skyscrapers. It will be with a suburban environment, which will certainly change the nature of your experience of the park. I mean, the traffic that will be generated by all that traffic, all the pets and all the house cats that will be feeding on the birds in the park, and the views from the park. Right now we have no limitations, for example, on development on ridgelines. Many states do in order to protect views, like on the Blue Ridge in Virginia. So we're starting now to see houses getting built up on the ridgelines, and you have reflective glass shining into the park, and you're beginning to see those effects. And then we have the lovely metropolis of Ellsworth, which is slowly steadily increasing its strip mall response to commercial development. They have a lovely, traditional, mostly brick-lined Main Street. You're familiar with it, and they've done a lot with it. And I think the town is doing its best to try and bring some color and character to the strip mall of High Road. They've planted some trees, and there's now sidewalks, so you can actually walk there sometimes. It's still a little risky. But the point is, if you're coming from New Jersey to have a world-class experience in a park, you don't want to drive through New Jersey after you've left New Jersey. You want to leave New Jersey behind and have a different kind of experience. I think one of the biggest challenges to our area in the greater Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth area is the same sort of issue we're going to face after the Plum Creek decisions are made and the projects are built, which is a failure of governance and process and taking an integrated, holistic look at what our preferred future is. We have different units of government who have different intentions. The town fathers of Ellsworth have their vision for what Ellsworth, I guess it's their vision. I mean, they're in charge, so that's what they've created. And we have other interests and other visions for other towns in our region. And, of course, the Acadia National Park staff have their hopes and fears about what's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years. So I wanted to move on a little bit and just mention, without going through all of it, but it was fun thinking about it in preparation for this discussion, the long, long history, 150-year history of the development of Maine's brand as an outdoor recreation destination. It goes back a long time, and because we have a kind of cultural amnesia, unless you look into it carefully, you don't realize that we stand on the shoulders of giants going way back to Thoreau, one of the first rusticators to come here in the mid-19th century. How many of you are born in Maine and from Maine? That's good. You're a minority. That's another interesting phenomenon we could talk about. But I grew up in New Jersey. How many of you grew up in New Jersey? Yay, New Jersey. The Turnpike State. We all know that's not fair because New Jersey has a lot of beautiful countryside. My father worked on the 34th floor of a big business building in Manhattan for about 25 or 30 years. And I'll tell you one thing, I can get around Manhattan a lot easier than I can get around Lewiston. It's an interesting experience. But on his bedside table, and I remember this at age 10, and it never left me, he always had the current issue of Fortune magazine. He was interested in the business world and reading all that sort of stuff. But next to it was always Thoreau's North Maine Woods. And it was always fun to see him reading one or the other, looking back into one or the other. And he began to take me to Moosehead Lake in the 50s. And for him, it was getting away from it all. Do you know that phrase, getting away from it all? And the it he was getting away from, of course, was Manhattan, and it was phones and cars and trucks and things that go, and radios and all of that. And we had a different kind of camping experience in those days. We didn't have the kinds of fabrics. We didn't have the no-see-em netting. We didn't even have the mosquito netting when I was camping in that era. But we stood on the top of Kineo and sometime in the mid-50s and saw one of the last probably large log booms getting towed down from Subumic area towards Kineo. We explored the base of Kineo and looked at the old Kineo house and outbuildings that were abandoned. This was a big hotel complex, just like the one that we're going to see in the next 10 or 15 years. So changes happened a lot there. We'd stay at campsites and occasionally get into the woods and find an old logging camp. All the cabins caved in, but we'd find all kinds of detritus lying around. It was always very charming and interesting and kind of magical to see what had been there before. Occasional apple orchards with apples that we could still pull off trees that were struggling to find some sunshine with spruce trees overgrowing them and what have you. So I know the change does come, but I think there is a constant. If you look at this 150 years, people, I don't think, get less of an inspirational experience from looking at the sunset from Cadillac Mountain or hearing the cry of the loon on Allegash Lake. It's that same experience, and I think we need it just as much today as we did when Thoreau went up to see the last white pines before they got cut, because they'd all been cut in Massachusetts when he was a young man. And, of course, Europe had taken care of its trees before that. I'm out of time, aren't I?
Do you want to take a couple more minutes?
I have a couple more minutes. Well, I mentioned the issue of governance, and I was reading the draft of the Comprehensive Plan for the Land Use Regulation Commission. It's a draft comprehensive plan for purposes of discussion. It's not a final plan on all that. But right early in it, they speak about an analysis of development trends over the past 35 years, and I'm quoting, reveals that existing LURC rules are inadequate to prevent dispersing development, and recent ownership changes increase the risk of significant changes in the qualities that have characterized this unique part of the state for so long. So we have a very big challenge, I think, to rise to this occasion and do the best by the North Woods and respect that 150 years of tradition. This isn't something that was stir and mix and put in the oven for 5 minutes. It's got a lot of history to it, and I think what we had, we need to continue to protect to give people the kinds of experiences they still need and maybe need more. When Acadia was created, there were 75 million people in the country. Now there's 300 million people. The founders of Acadia had no idea that they were creating a park that would have to serve that kind of population and that kind of pressure. And if they'd known what was going to happen between Ellsworth and Bar Harbor, they would have bought that land as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ted.
In a second, I'm going to invite questions and responses, but as I listen to all three of these really terrific and clear and thoughtful presentations, a couple things seem like patterns. One is the theme of the good news within the bad news and the danger of overstating the bad news, as I did with the timber industry in my introduction. And also the way in which all of the speakers model refusing to make choices between values of environmental stewardship, economic vitality, and community vibrancy, which is clearly the project that we all have to share in as we think about the future of the Maine Woods and of Maine. But I'd also say that Ted's talk and some of the other notes raise a set of questions which remain potential bad news in the future. Do we have governance and planning practices adequate to building the vision that the speakers have talked about? How do we deal with issues of sprawl and population density and commercialization pressures? How do we deal with issues of a new economy still too often built on seasonal labor? And informal and unstable labor, and how do we deal with longstanding issues of environmental pollution and resource degradation that will still continue to pressure us, if not plague us, as the good news becomes better news? And now that I've palavered enough to give people time to think, let me invite questions.